Chromosomes, little strands of nucleic acids and proteins, are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and for 30 years, I have been both the CEO of Technology Partners and the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. Before we get started, I'm excited to share that my book, Something Extra, is now available. It is rooted in the remarkable spirit of our daughter, Allie, and the heartfelt conversations we've had on the podcast. You'll find wisdom and practical tools to ignite the leader within you and uncover your own something extra. Visit somethingextrabook.com or find it at Amazon or in all major bookstores to order your copy today. It is my pleasure to have Sudha Sarvana on the show today. Sudha has been at Deloitte for the past 9.5 years and is the Global Chief Digital Solutions Officer. Prior to that, he held the deputy CIO role in the U.S. member firm. Welcome, my friend, to the Something Extra podcast. I have been looking so forward to this time with you, and I'm excited. We've been trying to make this happen for a while, Sudha, you know, but finally we're making the time here, and I'm so excited for our conversation today.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of your show and whatnot. And I've listened to some of your podcasts in the past. I listen to that whenever I exercise, when I'm on a treadmill and or riding my bike. It's available for anybody to listen to. So I enjoy listening to different perspectives, different experiences from all the professionals that you brought in before.
Yes. Well, it'll be fun. It's going to be fun, and you've got a lot of experiences and a lot of wisdom and insight yourself, Sudha, so I cannot wait for our listeners that don't know you to get to know you better. Okay, let's just start with this. I know you grew up in India, and you studied physics, and before you moved into IT management, how did your roots really shape your worldview growing up in India?
Well, it's the completely different perspective where I grew up and where I am now. The chasm is too wide, to be perfectly honest with you. I grew up in a very poor family. We were 8 of us, 6 kids and parents. We lived in a 200 square foot house, if you can imagine that. And, you know, we learned to live with the basics. And you know what? We were very happy. Because we got the best education, caring and loving parents. And we are a bunch of friends in the neighborhood, and we grew up pretty happy. Didn't have any concerns of the world and whatnot. And now in the U.S., after I came to the U.S. about, 35-some years ago, my life changed for good. Completely, you know, it was a different experience, different perspective. I had to learn the language. Believe it or not, when I came to the U.S., I couldn't speak in English. And I had to learn the hard way because, of course, when you're growing up in India, and you go to some of the colleges that I went to, most of the teachers and professors, they actually speak to you in the local language of their preference. And, it was like that for me. But I never forced myself to speak in English, even though I learned everything in English and whatnot. From growing up from that perspective with a completely different set of cultural nuances coming to the U.S. was a shocking experience. But over a period of time, I got adjusted to that. And and I have no regrets. I enjoy doing what I'm doing, and I enjoy my new chosen country of choice. Right. And you know, it's God has blessed me tremendously with that.
Well, our country is better because you're in it, Suda. I can tell you that. So, but I love what you said about growing up, not having a lot, but you had a happy life because you had love from your family and your mom and your dad and your siblings, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I think that sometimes there's a misnomer there that you need more to be happy. And we've seen the same thing in El Salvador and some of the countries that we have traveled to, like for mission work. I mean, they're happy. And sometimes the more you have, you and I have talked about that, the more you have, the more headaches you have.
Exactly. Right? Exactly right.
That is so, I love that. How old were you, Suda, when you came to the United States?
29 years old.
29. How hard was it for you to learn English?
It was difficult because I spoke in broken English for the most part. And some of the colleagues that I work with, they started correcting me and they were apologizing for correcting me. In fact, I gave them the permission to correct me anytime, anywhere, whenever I say something that didn't sound right, you know. Mm-hmm. So that was a big help. And I maintain that even today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that tells me something else about you, that you are open to feedback and you're humble enough to know, hey, I need some help. I need help from my friends around me, right? So, Suda, I want to talk about what sparked your love and your passion for technology. Where did that come from?
I would say the most important thing for me was the curiosity. You know, I was always curious about how things work, and I was always fascinated with the original spark which led someone to invent something instead of just admiring the problem. I'm still the same way. I look at something and I start thinking about, you know, why does it work the way it does? Why isn't it, you know, operate this way or the other way and all of that? I think that helps me to really go deeper to understand all aspects of what that is. So I would say the number one thing was curiosity and fascination that led me to this area of technology.
And obviously,
you kind of mentioned that earlier. When I got my nuclear and atomic physics and, you know, electronic instrumentation degree, my natural path was to go and work for nuclear power plant in the nuclear research center. But those opportunities are just far and few, and few and far between, right? Mm-hmm. And at that time, the whole software development revolution was happening right in front of me. At that time, the demand was so high for programmers. And that's when I decided to go back to computer science and started coding. And I fell in love with it.
I'm so glad because I was going to ask you about where the pivot. I wanted to understand because I knew that you had studied physics.
Yeah.
That was a big time back then.
It was.
My husband, Greg, and you are the same age, and the same thing was happening with him, and he got a fascination, and then that led to one thing after the other and programming, and now with Technology Partners. So, you know, you speak multiple languages. Tell me all the languages that you speak, you know, Suda, and now English too, right?
Yeah. I speak in my mother tongue, which is Kannada, which is part of a state called Karnataka in India. I also speak in national language, Hindi, a national language of India, that is Hindi. Then the local language called Marathi, which is where I grew up in a state called Maharashtra. And of course, English. Then I also took Spanish and French classes a few years back. So I kind of understand most of the words, and you know, I can, you know, put two and two together, and I can get by. So
yeah.
I would say about 4 plus 2.
Well, you know, and we're going to talk about this, but you've led global teams. I mean, how has that really influenced your leadership style and the way that you, you know, have managed people over the years? I mean, you probably understand a lot of different cultures and.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. In fact, I would say the number one would be listen more. When especially, you know, I learned a long time ago, if someone speaks to you with an accent, that means they know one more language than you do, most likely.
Oh, that's good.
So I learned to respect that. And obviously listening comes first. And I would say the number two is take the high road and be more empathetic with people. Make sure you're also aware of the cultural awareness and the nuances, because every culture has a little different nuances when you, the way you speak to them, the way you interact with them. In some culture, you know, being bold and direct is the best way. Like point A to point B, straight line is the best answer. In some culture, it is a disaster. because when you start having those type of conversation, people back off. Literally, mm-hmm. physically, they back off. And they want to have that space, and they are wondering why in the world you're being so rude. Well, the culture you're from, it is perfectly normal. So I think you have to have that cultural awareness. So when you learn the language, you're not just learning the language, you're kind of learning the cultural aspect of that individual or that group by default. You know, mm-hmm. when I was in the Middle East, or working in the Middle East, I could understand Arabic because I was there for quite some time, and I kind of knew what to say, what not to do, and how I sit in front of other people, how I cross my legs, and you know where my feet is pointed, and all of that. Those things are really important, and you have to be cognizant of that and make sure that you know you're looking at this world from their perspective.
That is so good. That is gold. That is gold there. And I'm thinking as you were talking about that, I'm going to go back to the other trait that you talked about, the curiosity.
Yeah.
And you may say, how do I do that? Right. Well, be more curious, you know, try to ask questions of them. Right. And get to know, seek to understand, you know, is kind of what I'm thinking. So that's really, really good advice. So let's kind of move into your career. You've worked at a lot of iconic organizations, Suda. You worked at, I think you worked at Enterprise for 9 years. Tell me just a little bit, what one maybe foundational leadership trait did you learn at Enterprise that you've carried forward?
Oh my gosh, there's a lot. quite honestly, it changed everything because I worked for a guy named Bill Snyder. He was the CIO, and actually he believed in me. And he gave me opportunities after opportunities when I didn't think I had what it took to be successful. I had no idea about certain things that he asked me to do. How do you become an expert in that? But I was thrown into that mix and thrown into the fire, so to speak. And that's how he was, because he trusted me completely, and he knew I was going to struggle through it and come out successful. I owe my entire success to Bill Snyder, who actually gave mm-hmm. me all the challenging opportunities. He moved me around seven times within the organization, gave me all the guidance I needed, and he mentored me personally and provided all the deep insights and how to get things done in a very complex global organization. And the way it was thinking, the way his thought process was extremely valuable for me, because I'm a point A to point B, straight line is the best answer type of person when it comes to execution. But he taught me a lot of other things that actually goes hand in hand with that, like relationship and being influential and, you know, driving to results and carrying people with you and all of that. So I learned a lot from him through my Enterprise days, and I'm extremely thankful for him.
Oh, goodness. I love that so much. And I know you, because we've talked on the sideline. Yeah. I mean, you've mentored, no telling, hundreds. And there's people that still are saying, hey, can I continue to be mentored by you? I'm sure, you know, Suda, you saw what he deposited into you. And I'm sure that that is a big reason why you want to make sure that you're paying it forward for others. That's really beautiful. Well, I know that you were at Extension Health too. And I think you led one of the largest business transformations in healthcare. What was that experience like?
When it comes to Extension Health, I think you can forget their mission. It's a mission-focused organization based on, you know, saving lives, right? Yes. When I say saving lives, it basically means, you know, through an approach that considers patients' spiritual, physical, mental needs, we can pretty much call it as a holistic approach to wellness, right?
Yes.
Not a lot of healthcare organizations do that. You know, obviously, it is a Christ-centered ministry, and it was easy for me to latch onto that mission and the purpose, what they do, why they do it, and how they do it. I would say the second thing was serving those who are poor and the vulnerable in the community where they serve. This is that really meant a lot to me, because I had people within my family that they went through a lot of healthcare struggles and all of that for years. And, I learned a lot about, the organization, Extension Health, and why they do that. You know, it is based on a fundamental principle that started, 600 some years ago, when a couple of nuns in Paris and in Europe started this organization, serving those in the community who did not have any other means for getting healthcare or any kind of help. From an overall perspective on the program that I was privileged to lead along with some of my colleagues, it was a 4-year-long business transformation program, and ironically, it was we are 2 years behind when we all arrived, and we had to catch up on delivering over 22 different highly integrated set of products within the remaining 2 years. So that was probably one of the most complex undertaking of my career. My peers and our collective teams not only caught up and delivered the entire program in less than 2 years, but we did that about, I would say, at least 4 months before that 2-year deadline came in. It was probably one of the greatest career-making projects for all of us who were involved in that transformation journey. But ultimately, we were able to accomplish this mission impossible, we called it. The future of Extension Health. In fact, some of my colleagues, mm-hmm. they had this Mission Impossible theme on the phone. The phone rang, it had that, the background music coming from Mission Impossible movie. It was kind of funny, but, we actually delivered, and it was an entirely team effort across multiple domains, and we all came through.
That's remarkable. That is remarkable, Suda. What do you think, what were the major through lines there? I mean, what was it about that team that you were on that allowed you guys to do that? Because, could have been another team and not, they could still be 2 years behind.
Yeah, in fact, we did something different. Every person that we hired, we told them about what are we planning to do. This is a mission-oriented organization, and we have a finite timeline to get this thing done. And we also were very transparent with them, saying, this is not going to be a business as usual type of project. It's going to be long hours working on weekends and all of that. And of course, we compensated everybody for that. And I think the organization was smart enough to recognize that there's going to be a lot of sacrifices people are going to make. Yes. And the question is, how do you actually, compensate for that? Once we actually addressed all of that, everybody that came to work, we had one purpose and mission in our mind, and that is to save lives. every dollar we save, that goes towards the charitable part of the organization, right? That's serving the poor and the vulnerable in the community. And I don't know how else to explain other than the fact that we were just focused towards a mission that
one
made
mission.
Personal sense to us, all of us. Yes, one mission.
Yeah, a purpose much bigger than yourself.
Exactly, yeah.
It's easier to buy into that, right? When you have a mission like that. That's amazing. Well, I want to spend some time on Deloitte because you moved into global leadership at Deloitte. How many associates were you overseeing at one time? I know it was like in the thousands.
Yeah, I know. At one point in time, I had a dual role of leading the product development team for both US and global. At that time, we were close to 10,000 some people. So half of that was probably just the eco partners and, our vendors. So that's how large that organization was.
That is a lot of people. That's a lot of people. I want to just ask you this. I mean, it was global. You've got that many people. Mm-hmm. What were some of the major tenets, Suda, that you put in place to help you be successful with it? Because that is an organization at scale.
Yeah. You know, you have to understand the overall context first, right? And given the sheer size of the organization, I would say we were probably operating at least 150 countries, and finding common solutions to solve problems was not always easy. Mm-hmm. Because every country, every geography has a different need, different composition, different tax and regulatory needs and whatnot. So finding a common solution that works for everybody was a big deal. I would say the second thing we have to really pay attention to was the language barrier, the cultural barrier, and the geographical diversification. You know, takes time. And, you know, obviously not only it takes time, but effort and patience that goes along with that too, right? So really have to understand where people are and, you know, and collaborating to find the consensus and commonality was non-negotiable. Because if you go with the posture of, you know what, we are doing this, this is the solution you're going to get. And, oh, by the way, you have no choice in the matter. That is not going to work at all. That is not going to, that's a deal breaker, right? So you have to be very cognizant of understanding the overall cultural nuances and the where the people are coming from, you know, especially, you know, for example, you know, if we're having conversation with someone in, let's say, Japan, and we probably need a translator on the call. So you have to make room for that and make sure that everybody understands what we are saying that is not only technically correct, but also from a cultural aspect, it is projected correctly.
Mm-hmm. That's so good.
Yeah.
So good. well, goodness gracious, I've got so many other questions here for you. Lots of questions. But, I mean, let's talk about leadership philosophy. So you have been a leader that has been described as really inspiring trust. You know, how have you done that personally, Suda?
Yeah, I'm going to ask a very simple question. How do you know when you trust someone in business? I don't know. I don't think you need to answer that question, but I'm just going to say the flash news is not the feeling or the sensation you have, correct? When you trust somebody, when we say we trust somebody, what we are really saying is three things. You know, one, they are competent to do their job really well. Second, they are very sincere. They don't make up things. And number three is, are they reliable? Over a period of time, when we go through the ups and downs of the business, are they reliable? So if you really spend some time on understanding those three components, you know, it's the foundation of trust, right? I personally focus on creating an inclusive environment where people feel respected and empowered at the same time. I have the habit of tapping on people's shoulders and tapping into their enormous reservoir of talent and experience and all that, right? Because let's face it, we hire the best people. We go through the extent of hiring the best people. Why not cut them loose and let them do their job and they hire to do, right? And instead of micromanaging. And yes, that has really worked for me, not only at Deloitte, but also before that. You know, I've always adopted that principle. I'm a firm believer that there should be no permanent characterization of an individual if they make mistakes. In fact, that's how I believe people learn and grow and stretch themselves, and they become more reliable and competent. And that goes back to what I said earlier about building that trust. So when you do all those three things correctly, and people want you to be around, and you know, they give you opportunities to stretch yourself and get promoted and all of that. So good things happen when you go through all of that.
Right. Well, I love that. What you talked about, really making it a safe place, basically a safe environment for people to make mistakes, right? But innovation, I would say, does not happen unless you're trying things and experimenting. And that part of innovation, Suda, and not everything you do is going to work, right? So people are going to, you know, some things are not going to work, and sometimes people are going to make mistakes. But I think creating that environment where people feel safe to try things is really a paramount trait for a leader.
Yeah, if you keep slapping people's hand every time they make mistake, you know, they're going to actually regress. They're not going to move forward because they're going to be afraid of the ramification that comes, you know, for making mistakes. And I firmly believe that, you know, if you try five things and fail in four, what happens in the fifth one is the $1 billion idea that you come up with, right?
That's right.
So you have to allow people to make mistakes. And obviously, we always do the debrief, right? After you do some experimentation and things don't work out, then the question is, what did you learn from that? What would you do differently and all of that? And I think most companies kind of have that process of doing that, you know, formally or informally. And that's where you actually, you know, observe the thought process that went into the experimentation. You know, what were you looking for? What happened? What is the inference? And by the way, are you going to recommend this to the leadership team moving forward if this was your money you're spending, right? So then there is that part of that is also entrepreneurial, because most of the entrepreneurs that we know, you know, they mortgage their house to, you know, fund their passion and whatnot, right? So in the corporate environment, we don't think that way, but we should.
Yes. Yeah. It's entrepreneurial. You want your people to be entrepreneurial, right?
I like that
An entrepreneur
word. Yes.
Within the organization. Yeah. I love that. Well, I've got so much more to talk about with you, Suda, just scores and scores of questions here, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with my friend Suda Savrana on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend, Suda Savrana. So, Suda, I want to ask you a question. So, what is one principle that you will never compromise? Because there's always non-negotiables as a leader. What is one principle that you will never compromise on as a leader?
I would say the number one would be trust. And, of course, I could use that, you know, word integrity, too.
Integrity, right.
But, you know, to me, it's kind of integrity is part of the trust. Obviously, you cannot earn trust from somebody without the integrity part, right?
Mm-hmm.
So once you lose that trust, it is extremely hard, if not impossible, to regain that. So everybody has to understand that. You could actually build 10 years, 20 years, 30 years of worth of trust with somebody. You make one mistake. Well, let me put it this way, it's not necessarily a mistake. it's you know, the word I use, it's knowingly doing something wrong.
Mm.
You know you had a choice, but you made a choice that is not correct. That is not a mistake, right? So that is in our vernacular, we'll say disobedience, right?
Yes.
And I think that's the most important thing. Once you lose that, it's almost impossible to regain that trust anywhere. So never compromise.
Yeah, it's kind of a cat, you know, it's a crack in your character.
Exactly.
If you knowingly know that this is the right thing to do and you choose not to do it. You and I both love Scott Richard.
Yeah.
Scott's a good friend of both of ours. And Suda, I'll never forget him saying, he said, you know, trust is built in drops, but lost in buckets.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I thought that was such a great way to describe it.
So, I've heard him say that too. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So, let me ask you this. If for a young professional, and I know, and we could spend so much time on mentoring because I know mentoring is so important to you. You've been mentored, you've mentored people, hundreds probably over your career. But for a young professional that wants to grow into that CIO, that C-suite for the technologists, either CIO, CISO, CTO, CTO, what advice would you give them?
Well, several things comes to my mind. Let's see if I can go in a sequence. My advice is to continue to build deep technical expertise. And if you're a CIO, CTO, you got to know that, right? And things are changing all the time around us. So you got to figure out a way to stay on top of it. Otherwise, you know, remember what I said, something about trust, competency, sincerity, and reliability.
Yes.
When you're not competent, it's kind of hard to do your job really, really well, right?
Right.
But you know, I would say equally focus on building the business acumen, because you know we love the idea of being a technologist and talk techie terms and use the jargon everywhere. But it's really, really important to understand the business, the domain, and become an expert in that. Third one, I would say leadership and communication skills. Those two go hand in hand. These are really not in any kind of a particular order, but you know, it's not good enough to be a technologist and just say, I've made it. You know, you got to have all of those things. And you know, going back to what I said earlier, being curious is always an important aspect of being a CIO and CTO. You know, take on the stretch opportunities and seek out mentors. You know, look, you know, obviously we kind of know within the organization who people respect the most. You go after them and say, you know what, hey, would you be able to spend, 15 minutes, 30 minutes every other week with me and whatnot? I have never come across anybody that said no to me when I asked for that help. And whenever people come out and ask me for help, I have never said no to anybody in my entire career. Obviously, you know, since you mentioned CIOs and CTOs, you know, obviously they will succeed not just because they know the technology, but by aligning it with the business and company strategy and really inspiring their people to actually deliver it. Without that, I don't know how you actually build the credibility within any organization, right? It's really important to build your network also intentionally within the company or outside the company and start building the obligations, especially with influential leaders, before you cash it in later, right? Because you know, once you start building that obligation for doing something above and beyond when nobody really asked you to do, you know, people remember that. And then you can cash it on sometime in the future. And for my mentees, one of the things that I tell them constantly is have your own board of advisors. Pick three, four, five people that can give you honest advice on how do you navigate through your career and become successful within the organization or outside the organization, because you can do a lot of things outside the organization, being part of the charitable organization and all of that, right? And one last thing that comes to my mind is don't hesitate to acknowledge success and broadcast your own success, because most of the time we are very timid. We are shy about you know, the technologies, we don't care about, you know, getting a pat on the back, but it's actually really important for you and your team to be recognized publicly. And I would say most people don't do that well. So those are the right things that comes to my mind.
That's so good. That's so good. And I agree with you. I mean, in human nature, sometimes, Suda, we do shy away from that because it feels a little bit of self-promotion. Yeah. But there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. And you've got to let people know what you've contributed, right? And what you've contributed to the organization. Those are that I just love everything that you just said. That was so good. Well, let's talk about this. You've worked in AI, blockchain, IoT. There's always something new, right? AI is really the buzz right now. But is there a technology right now, Suda, that really excites you for the future that you think is going to be a huge game changer?
Well, hands down, the answer is AI. I know everybody keeps talking about that, and there is a reason for that. You know, it's not, you know, when you think about AI, you know, it's not just a standalone technology, you know, but it is a multiplier that enhances everything you just talked about, the IoT, predictive analytics, RPA, AI, and all of that, right? So AI's ability to shift organization from reactive, that most companies are in, to predictive, to autonomous decision-making. This will actually transform how we work and innovate in the future. I don't think anybody can take a shortcut on this one or get a pass for pass for this, because it is that important.
Yeah, I agree. I love the word that you said, the word that I keyed in on there, Suda, was multiplier. Yeah,
exactly.
It's going to be a force multiplier, right? So we have to be, we don't need to be fearful of it. We need to be looking at it and embracing it. You went through the AI executive program at MIT.
Yeah.
Which is so cool. Were there like one or two useful learnings that you took away from that program?
Well, actually, I did that for a couple of reasons. One is I took AI class when I was going through the computer management program. I just wanted to see how much has changed. So I think that was the curiosity that led me to signing up for this executive program within MIT. And one of the things, you know, that I learned, not only from the course itself, but also from some of the participants, you know, what really matters is when you start looking at the AI, what it can do, you have a tremendous responsibility of making sure that, you know, the data that you're consuming, the infrastructure that you rely on, has you know, all the important aspects like data governance and data quality and ethical frameworks and all of that. Most people, when they start talking about the surface level, they don't really talk about the underneath, you know, of the data and the infrastructure, how the AI makes itself work and all of that, and why that it becomes more reliable over a period of time. Those are the things that, you know, you don't read much in the articles, right? So it comes from practitioners who have been there and done that, and you know, have struggled through all the ups and downs. And also a different aspect of that was the responsibility of each leader within an organization. How do you take this head on and deal with all the confusions and all the pushbacks, but yet at the same time, you still need to make progress and you keep driving for the results and all of that, and embrace this before you become completely outdated, right? Another one is the strategy and vision. And how do you actually enable that in a treat AI as a business enabler and not just as a technology to that embeds into the company's strategy with the clear priorities, right? Whether it's, you have to be mindful of the fact that it's improving customer experience, driving, you know, operational excellence or efficiency, or creating new products or revenue streams. These are all need to be a part of this strategy and with a vision. Otherwise, why would you spend all that dollars on something that's going to just wither away and just become, you know, another shiny object that you chase, right? The last one that I learned from that was, you know, the impact of AI on the people and the culture. The biggest shift will be on the workforce. And you and I talked about this before too.
Yes.
I would say leaders need to actually prepare and reskill their team, and also at the same time foster a culture of experimentation and address concerns about job displacement and be very transparent with people. If you don't do that, then you know, you're really not doing your job, right?
The planning and the preparation phase for this is very important.
Absolutely.
Right, Suda? I mean, you can't just, because the reality is there are some jobs that will go away.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't wait until
they
completely go away to start planning for that. So that's really good. That's really good. I'm going to ask you this question. So global leadership, I mean, you've led teams across India, Argentina, Colombia, Ukraine. I think you said Deloitte was 150 countries, something like that. I think you said the Philippines. What have you learned about cross-cultural leadership? And we've already touched on this a bit because you've said you've got to learn about the culture.
Yeah.
You've got to make sure you understand the culture. Is there anything else, Suda, that you would say? I mean, communication, obviously, language, culture.
Yeah, I think when you know, this is my personal observation, you know, I could be completely, you know, on a tangent here, but the people look different from the outside, but all of them have basic needs, basic concerns, basic desires with, you know, different goals and objectives and ambition that whatever they may have, right? I find that there are more commonalities than differences.
Yes.
Yeah. And another thing that comes to my mind is I also learned people like to be treated fairly and with dignity, compassion and respect and all of that, right? Regardless of what country they're in, where they're coming from, their background, doesn't really matter, because the fundamental needs for everybody is, you know, to be treated fairly and with, you know, with dignity and all of that. I mentioned it to you, that shows my age too, right? My entire career spanning about 40 years just in IT, I have not come across a single individual who does not like to be recognized and acknowledged for doing an excellent work. They might shy away.
Yeah.
They don't want the public public recognition.
Yeah.
But I have not come across a single person that really hated that, right? So personally, I take all the opportunities to celebrate success with everybody and reward and recognize people publicly and all of that. And that's part of the cultural aspect that you have to continue to fuel to make sure that, you know, you're building a great organization with a great culture where people want to come and work.
Yeah, that's so beautiful.
Yeah.
That is so beautiful. People care about the same things. I mean, I haven't worked globally, but we've done mission trips.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. I mean, they love their children just like we do. They want a good life
exactly.
for their children. I mean, there are so many. I love what you said. There's just more commonalities.
Yeah, those are all ontological distinctions, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure. Well, I know you've served on a lot of boards. Suda, I'm sure you get asked every week, would you come serve on this board? You know, how do you choose where to give your time and talent? I mean, because I know you have opportunities all the time coming to you. Everybody wants a piece of Suda. How do you make those choices, Suda, for yourself?
Yeah, I would say, and I'll give you a short answer first. You know, I pretty much enjoy giving back to the community because being in the U.S., you know, I feel not only privileged, but completely blessed. So what do I do in return? I give back. So especially if the purpose of their cause is pretty much in alignment with what I really care about. Right. That's a short answer. The long answer would be it really offers me a great opportunity to give back, not only give back to the community, but also share professional expertise in areas like, for me, it is governance, technology, a role of AI that can play in the organization I'm serving as a board member, and also get different perspectives from other board members who are all equally successful individuals. from different aspects of the, you know, the corporate world, right? And what we are really focused on is to make an impact on the organization's mission. And if the mission is aligned with what you really care about, magic happens, right? And one other thing, you know, which is kind of side benefit, it also has benefit more for me personally, like developing leadership and strategic skills, building my professional network, and gaining like a better sense of purpose and fulfillment. Because it is, you know, you think you got it all and you've been doing this for a long time. You kind of, sometimes you get the feeling like, you know what, I can do this. But suddenly you're sitting across someone who's operating at a much different level than you are. Then all you have to do is just shut up and listen and learn. And, you know, for me, it is extremely beneficial for my, you know, career perspective.
For your
well.
Development?
Yes, my development. Yeah.
Yes. When we were talking about young professionals, that's one thing I would say. Look for a young professionals board that you can serve on. You would be so amazed. The network for sure. But also what you can learn, because you may be sitting there as an IT professional, but the person across from you is a maven in marketing. You're gonna learn. So that I just think serving is, I just think everybody should be serving in some capacity.
I think they should.
You know? Yes. Well, okay. So this is a little more personal. You're married to Stephanie and you've been married for many, many years. You've raised two grown children. Suda, I love this about you, and I won't ever forget this. And it made such an impression on me. I remember being at the award ceremony where you accepted the Super Global Finalist St. Louis CIO Orbi Award a few years ago. That's a mouthful. And what I remember is in your acceptance speech, how you honored Stephanie. And you gave so much credit back to her. What's your family? How has your family impacted even your leadership and what you've been able to do in your career?
That's a
loaded
question, but I like that question. You know, it allows me to just get straight from my heart. And my family is my power plant. Okay. You know, obviously they give me the purpose to wake up in the morning and deal with anything that comes my way. And, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of remember, you know what, whatever I do has a direct impact on my family. So I choose to make sure that I make all the good choices and whatnot, because not doing so will have a direct consequence on my family, right? So they are the source of my inspiration and strength, you know, especially Stephanie. Through all the ups and downs, you know, we've been married for 34 years, and you know, as the family unit, I know we are all different, right? Or my kids think differently, act differently, and we have different strengths and weaknesses, but we deeply care about each other and love each other no matter, you know, what. You know, that is unconditional love. I learned a long time ago, one size does not fit all. So you have to work with each family member.
Your children are all different.
Exactly, yeah. You have to meet where they are. And business, you know, to me is, you know, the correlation to that business is, you know, business is no different. You treat everyone with dignity, respect, and work, and work with them in a way that works for both parties. And you stay focused on what are you trying to accomplish? What is your mission at hand? And there is always a give and take, but you never lose sight of what is really important that is in front of you. And that's what keeps me going. And I learned something from my family, and I apply that to work, and I learned something from the business, and also apply that to my family life. You know? So it's a it's a two-way thing. But, you know, make no mistake, my wife is my power plant, nuclear power plant, keeps throwing all the energies out.
I love that. I've not ever had anyone say that, but I love that. Yeah, you know, because we've been to dinner with you and Stephanie, and just, you know how important our family is to us. And I can't, I, years ago, our middle daughter, because they're all three of our children are super different, and our grandson is even more different than the other three. But I remember Paige saying years ago, she said, "You know what?" She goes, "It takes all of us to make one of us."
Oh, very nice.
And she was young. I mean, she was maybe 12.
Wow.
She goes, "It takes all of us to make one of us." And what she was really saying is, Suda, you know, that because we're different, we sharpen one another and we, you know, help one another be more whole, you know,
exactly.
I think. So grateful for that. Oh goodness, you've got so much here. You're a musician. You're an avid cyclist. I mean, tell me just a little bit. I mean, what parallels have you seen between music and leadership?
Sina? Oh, quite a few. In fact, I'll start with the music first, right? And I'm like you said, I'm an audiophile. I would call myself as a critical listener. Because I'm looking for all the different aspects of, you know, marveling the whole singers and the musicians and the sound engineers and the producers and the technology that goes hand in hand with all of this. You know, it all comes together like a magic. When you listen to a good piece of music, you kind of like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. So when you actually dissect and go down of each of these areas, right? It's a discourse. Each of them have their own discourse behind the skill sets and the whatever they're performing, right? And each one is different. And they all have different type of skill sets and whatnot. But when they produce a music, when that comes together and when you start listening to that, you can't tell anything, but you're just enjoying the music. You know, it's the same way I would say in leading a team. I try to do my best, you know, like the best artist or the best engineers, singers, producers, whatever it is, right? The takeaway for me is how can I be like them and create a wow moment for my stakeholders? My, you know, that includes my team and my customers and everybody else in that, right? So it's just like, you know, me listening to, you know, finally, produced music and having that, you know, a heartfelt moment. I would like to replicate that in business by working with my team and creating that wow moment for my customers.
Beautiful symphony.
Yeah, exactly.
It's made up of many different parts, right? Yeah. I love that. Well, okay. I have one more question for you, Suda. This is called Something Extra.
Okay.
What do you believe is the something extra every leader needs?
I would say be influential with a high dose of empathy. When everything is around is about to change, or in some cases changing already, right? There's a lot of changes happening in our domain. So we have to anticipate the worst case and the best case scenario and be proactive with our action right now. Versus just reacting to an unpleasant situation that might come up later.
Yes.
So I would say, you know, be influential with a high dose of empathy, because people are going to struggle through all these changes. As leaders, you have the responsibility to make sure that you calm the storm and, you know, let everybody come with you versus dropping bodies off behind
you. Yes, that's so good. Suda, I have absolutely loved this conversation with you. I thank you so much, my friend. I appreciate you taking the time to be on the show today. And I know that you're going to really help our listeners. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for investing your time and energy in this. And I can't thank you enough for just allowing me the chance to speak from my heart.
Yes, very good.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.